Our second case this morning is 2019-295, Joni Bay et al. Versus Jeffrey Raceaware. For the appellant, Mr. Swan.
Chief Justice O'Connor, Your Honors, may it please the court. My name is Dennis Edward Swan of Swan & Swan, and I'm here today representing the appellant, Jeffrey Raceaware. I'm joined today at the appellant's table by Professor Eugene Volek for the Electronic Frontier Foundation. We will be splitting our time this morning. I will take the initial 5 minutes of the total 15. Professor Volek will then take the remainder, and hopefully, if all goes according to plan, I will reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Your Honors, as this court is no doubt well aware, prior restraints on expression come to this court with a heavy presumption against their constitutional validity. Thus, the appellees carry a high burden of showing justification for the imposition of such restraint, a high burden which they cannot and have not met. Your Honors, we have a situation here arising in Mercer County, Ohio, involving a judicial order restraining the appellant for a period of 5 years from speaking broadly about the appellees or otherwise discussing their alleged culpability in crimes or the associated governmental inaction in the investigation of the same. The trial court's order contains three separate injunctions. Number one, it orders the appellant to remove from current publication any posting that, quote, relates to the petitioners. Number two, it requires that he refrain from posting any statements about the appellees on any social media service, website, discussion board, or similar outlet or service. And number three, the order requires that the appellant refrain from posting about the deaths of the petitioner's husbands in a manner that expresses, implies, or suggests that the petitioners are culpable in those deaths. The injunction in the case at bar is breathtakingly broad, and its infirmity should be apparent from the mere description.
So assuming we agree, but assuming we agree with you that, at least in some respect, it's overbroad, what kind of injunction would be okay?
Well, Your Honor, this court in O'Brien has said that if something is found to be judicially libelous or defamatory, its republication of the same statement can be prohibited.
So what would have to happen in a proceeding like this?
Well, O'Brien would say that there would need to be a judicial determination that what was said was libelous or defamatory.
Could a judge make that finding?
Well, Your Honor, this gets to a bit of a different point. The Ohio Constitution in Article 1, Section 11 says that in criminal cases for libel, you need both a jury and a determination of falsity. The problem here is that we have is a civil process superimposed over a criminal statute, which creates a conflict between the constitutional rights afforded to somebody and the process that we have seen play out here.
So what's the answer?
The answer, I believe, would be yes, though I think that insofar as we are going to have criminal violations for this order's, let's say that, for example, the appellant were to say something in violation of this order, what would occur is there would be a contempt hearing. The collateral bar rule in Ohio would prevent anybody from arguing about the underlying unconstitutionality of the order, and he'd be subject to criminal sanctions. So effectively, what would happen is he would be subject to criminal sanctions without having been provided those constitutional rights that the Ohio Constitution affords him. While I think that, yes, the answer to your question is a judge could do that, I do think it could pose potential constitutional problems with respect to the Ohio Constitution's guarantees.
Could the judge bar him from making statements directly to the petitioner?
Yes, I think that
are there any limits on that?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think that one-to-one speech, and Professor Volek will explain this in greater detail as he is one of the preeminent scholars on this issue. One-to-one speech, me saying something to you, is fundamentally different than me saying something about you to the public at large.
So in this case, the judge could say you can't contact the petitioner. You can't, but any other restriction would have to be found to be libelous first.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. Yes. One other point I'd like to make before my time expires, at least this initial point, is that there's been much ado about this leaving domestic violence victims without any recourse. I want to say two points on this. Number one, the underlying allegations that were silenced here were allegations of the most heinous domestic violence, that somebody committed a murder against their family members. Whether you believe that or not, That's what was silenced here. And the permutation of that that's perhaps the most damaging is imagine somebody, a woman gets out of a relationship, for example, and wants to talk about their ex as having abused them. The same logic that applied to get to this injunction would re-victimize that individual and make them be silenced from posting on Facebook about their past relationship. This has deep roots. It's a slippery slope, and I would ask that this court vacate this injunction. And with that, I'm going to cede.
Very briefly before you sit. So what you're saying here is that the Constitution protects, really, and maybe the professor can address this more directly, a free-for-all of allegation-slinging, allegations of heinous crimes or misconduct across all social media spectrums, and there are no limits.
I think the answer to that, Your Honor, is decidedly no. Okay. The O'Brien case had said that if somebody says something libelous or defamatory,
but after having been adjudicated and found libelous,
that's correct. And those due process protections are vital to ensure that we have free flow of ideas.
No protection of allegations alone,
unless they're determined to be libelous. That's correct.
Got it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honors, Eugene Volokh on behalf of AMICI, Electronic Frontier Foundation, 1851 Center, and various Ohio academics. Your Honor, let me turn to the question that you asked. The Supreme Court has had to deal with this in its libel cases, including in Garrison v. Louisiana in 1964, where the state libel law punish not only statements that are proven to be false, but also statements said with bad motives or for unjustifiable ends. That was a long-standing limitation dating back to Alexander Hamilton, as it happens in his capacity as a lawyer. The Supreme Court specifically rejected that. It said that even though statements that are found libelous could lead to civil liability, or in Garrison, even to criminal libel liability, there can't be liability simply on the theory that some statements are ill-motivated, which was the rationale, incidentally, of the court below, which we're asking you to reverse. So the Supreme Court said there is no vendetta speech or ill-motivated speech exception. So it is true that if people are accusing one another of misconduct, complicity in violence, corruption, increasingly we see online posts where women accuse men of sexual abuse. The remedy for that the law gives is a libel lawsuits. It could, in principle, be criminal libel liability, although I believe Ohio has repealed its criminal libel statute. But libel lawsuits are the proper remedy. O'Brien recognizes that. And, Your Honor, returning to your question, we think that the plaintiffs believe that the statements about them are false, the remedy is for them to file a libel lawsuit, get a determination, preferably by a jury, there would at least be a right to jury trial in that situation. And if there is a determination by a jury, then in that case, under this court's decision in O'Brien, the judicial determination that specific speech is defamatory must be made prior to any restraint, and an injunction against continued publication of that same speech may be proper.
So you don't think in this case, for example, the judge could hold a hearing, take evidence, make findings of facts, find that certain speech is defamatory, and say you cannot say that again?
Your Honor, we do not think that that's permissible, and that's for two reasons. One is the Ohio Constitution, which provides that in a criminal libel case, the jury has to be the finder of fact. And because an injunction is backed by the threat of criminal punishment, they're under the criminal contempt law, but it's effectively criminal contempt for punishment for violating an anti-libel injunction is effectively criminal libel. That requires there to be a jury finding, which makes sense, that if speech is to be suppressed on the theory that it is false, that's a determination that shouldn't be made by just one government official. A related point is, recall that Columbus Dispatch has no greater rights under the First Amendment than Mr. Rasawehr, and no lesser rights. So if a judge could issue an injunction ordering someone to stop making accusations, then the judge could issue an injunction ordering a newspaper to stop making those accusations. That, we think, is not right. We think it's even inconsistent with the First Amendment, which has long been understood as embodying this American tradition of jury trial decision-making rather than judicial
decision-making. So, counsel, you think nothing of the three, nothing that was contained in the three, I guess, prongs of the judicial order can stand? They couldn't be modified, refrain from any postings, if it would be refrain from postings about, you know, these two women, that wouldn't satisfy.
Your Honor, we think that nothing in paragraph 9 can stand. We agree with Mr. Asawir's counsel that the restriction, for example, on direct contact with
right.
is
okay.
permissible under cases like Roe v. Post Office Department, which says you can stop talking, the government can say stop talking to a person. But under cases like Keefe, Reorganization of Better Austin, the case from Illinois, where there was an injunction against leafleting sharply critical of a local businessman, the government can't say stop talking about the person.
Okay, so the process here, at some point, if they're found libelous statements through a civil action, there can be orders then similar to what is contained in this judge's orders.
Your Honor, after a libel, if there is a libel verdict
yes.
in favor of plaintiffs, yes, then the second sentence could essentially be reenacted or reimplemented on the theory of O'Brien that when specific speech is determined to be defamatory, publication of that same speech may be restrained. So that's the second sentence.
I mean, but you're not saying the identical speech. You're talking about the subject matter of that speech in posted in a manner.
Your Honor, if I may offer a friendly amendment, it's not it wouldn't be indeed identical, limited to identical, but it would have to be substantively the same.
Okay.
So not just on the same subject, but expressing the same facts, which, of course, libel law long has recognized that a statement may be, the courts may look at the gist of the statement.
Okay.
Your Honor, if I may just finish by turning to a point that Mr. Swan made. There's a case, it's not in our briefs because we just decided 2 weeks ago, Stark v. Stark from the Tennessee Court of Appeals. And in it, what happened was a woman who was married to a police officer was getting a divorce. She said that he had abused her, and then that the police department covered that up. And she posted a Facebook post about that. And a judge ordered her to take down that Facebook post. Because the judge concluded that it was harmful to the police officer's potential employment. The Court of Appeals dismissed the appeal because it was not properly perfected under Tennessee law. But that's an illustration, we think, of what can unconstitutionally happen if judges are just entitled to say, we don't like what you're saying. There was no finding of falsehood there. We don't know, of course, who was right and who's wrong. But we think that Ms. Stark had every right to express her views subject to the risk of a libel lawsuit, and that the injunction there was improper. We think the same thing is the case here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Milton.
Excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. My name is Ryan Milton on behalf of the Appellees. I intend to speak for 9 minutes and for our amici to speak for the remaining 6 minutes. The proposition of law that's before the court today has already been addressed in Toledo Blade versus Henry County Court of Common Pleas, where this court stated prior restraints are not unconstitutional per se. And so the question then becomes, well, where are prior restraints permitted? And they're permitted where the speech that is restrained is categorically unprotected speech, including where that speech is integral to illegal conduct.
Well, counsel, who determines what the nature of that speech is?
Whether it's illegal conduct? Is that the question?
The content. What process is there to determine the nature of the speech that we're talking about?
Sure. So in this case, that is, it's done through Ohio's menacing by stalking statute. And so you have a full civil hearing before the Court of Common Pleas, which occurred in this case. The court takes testimony and evidence and finds that there is a pattern of conduct, which includes, in this case, written communication, as the General Assembly acknowledged that could be part of the pattern of conduct.
But doesn't that written communication have to be directed to someone, the intended person or victim?
No, I don't believe that the statute requires that, nor does the law provide that. If you look at federal cases interpreting the federal stalking statute, they've applied this exact categorization of speech integral to illegal conduct about posts made to the public online that affect the petitioners. And I use affect, but more precisely, the Ohio statute requires that there be a finding of actual mental distress. This is not a situation where there's simple harassment or annoyance. We have actual mental distress where—
Counsel, a true statement publicized could cause mental distress.
It absolutely can.
So my question, I guess, is who determines that the quality of the statement is something that can be suppressed under the Constitution?
Okay, so Ohio's menacing by stalking statute acknowledges that statements made by a perpetrator can be both true statements or could be false statements. And so we recognize that a person who's engaging in stalking about their victims may very well say true things. He may say false things, but the effect on the victim is exactly the same. And in this case, yes, the statements were false. But a finding of falsity is not what is required in the context of—
But isn't that really disturbing from a First Amendment context, that you can say to that someone can go out and say murder someone, and you can't tell the truth about that because it might cause distress?
You can find situations where that would be troubling.
Well, it seems pretty troubling.
Well, Your Honor,
how do I know in this case if the facts if the facts are true or not, what he's saying?
Well, that is for the trial court to interpret all of the statements and the entire pattern of conduct and the effect.
Did the trial court ever find that this wasn't true?
No.
So if it was true, could we ban him from saying it?
Yes, under the menacing by stalking statute, the statements made by a person who is engaged in menacing by stalking, the truth or falsity is irrelevant. And it is up to the trial court and the procedural and the due process protections provided by the statute that are our safeguard against—
So I couldn't follow Donald Trump around and say that he is doing horrible things if that would cause him severe emotional distress.
Well, I think, okay, so what we have in that situation is there's a situation where there's a public figure and there are issues of public import, okay? And so in that context—
But does the menacing by stalking statute make an exception for public figures?
I don't believe on its face it does, no.
Okay, so explain to me why that would be different.
Okay, so— I think you have to look at what the petition in that case would entail, what the testimony would entail. You would have to say, first of all, there's an important mens rea element in the Ohio menacing by stalking statute, that the perpetrator has to engage in a pattern of conduct where he knowingly intends to cause mental distress to the victim, okay? And whether it's the president or whether it's my clients, if you are engaged in a pattern of conduct with the goal of causing them—
Well, I mean, isn't it, I mean, what if I want to cause mental distress to someone because I think they did something in the political sphere that's really wrong, and I want them to understand how American citizens feel about that. Isn't that kind of the heart of our constitutional protections?
No, I believe that our Constitution stops short of allowing people to intentionally cause anxiety and mental health problems to people. We may disagree on that point, but I think that's where the General Assembly intended.
I would like to turn to the paragraph 9 of the order, first sentence. Could the respondent go online and Facebook and say, dear daughter, today's your birthday. I miss you. I love you. Please call me.
No, you could not.
That's not a very harmful statement, is it?
No, but once you have a victim of stalking, and we make a reference to this in our brief, any statement to a victim of menacing by stalking, once that has been found, is a harmful statement, okay?
Please forgive me?
I think that is still harmful.
But is there a difference between violating a no-contact order, trying to access, send a letter, make a phone call and say that, and posting it somewhere where, in Justice Fisher's example, it can be accessed or not accessed. It's not a direct to the person.
Well, I think hypothetically, yes, there is a difference in that. There's not under the terms of this order. I think there are other avenues where something like that could be made. You could use another family as an intermediary. And at that point,
that's indirect contact.
It is indirect contact, but I think that it opens the avenue, and I think it would also indicate that if there's a genuine interest, the court that issued the order can look at remedying and repairing those family bonds.
Do you think that in today's, with technology and use of social media today, that you know, cases like Garrison that I think was cited in the 1960s, I mean, has the law changed with this with regard to First Amendment rights? And is there a way to still protect people from menacing by stalking and harassment and still afford people their First Amendment right to freedom of expression?
That's a very complex question. I think my first take on this in terms of technology is that the internet and social media has given a new avenue for stalkers to harass and menace their victims. But the legal principles...
How really, though? How? If it's not directed toward any person or individual?
So when you put a statement out on the internet and social media, it's put out for the whole world to see.
If the world seems to access it.
Yeah, or if you put up billboards in the county and you direct the entire population of a town of 9,000 people to go check out what's going on. You have to understand the entire context of this particular case, and I understand we're dealing with a much larger global principle, but the trial court is looking at this in the situation of a small town where you have actual testimony of serious, you know, mental distress. People saying, I can't go out to the store without people saying something to me. I have to go drive by this billboard every day, directing the entire public to go look at these very private issues, and I'm harmed by that. And so the internet has opened that up in a way that wasn't present in the 1960s, of course. But the legal principles, Gibboni, and speech integral to illegal conduct, that framework applies perfectly here today. And really, the Federal Circuit cases applying that framework.
I'm having trouble with this, the speech integral to conduct and how that works. So the government wants to pass a law that says no one shall do anything to bring into disrepute the President of the United States. Mm-hmm. Speech would seem to be integral to that. So therefore, that would be an exception under the First Amendment?
No, Justice DeWine, I think that is a situation where the underlying statute itself is facially invalid because that statute is aimed directly at speech. Whether you're looking at
what... Isn't here this statute at least partly aimed at speech? I mean, at least the way you interpret it?
It's not aimed at speech. It's aimed at a pattern of conduct which causes the victim to experience actual mental harm.
But you don't even need to have conduct here, right? Under your theory, under your interpretation of the statute.
Well, not under my interpretation of the statute, under the actual statute that the General Assembly passed.
It could be all speech, right?
It could be all speech, yes.
Okay, so what's the difference between that and my example then?
Because it has to do with the specific purpose of the statute. The purpose of the Ohio's menacing by stalking statute is to prevent.
So we can forbid some speech if we have the right purpose? That seems a...
No, we're not forbidding speech. We are forbidding conduct which causes harm, mental distress.
So he could have said this.
But conduct is speech in your view.
Yes, and we recognize that speech and conduct are intertwined. Sexual harassment is pure speech. And it's justified under the speech integral to illegal conduct framework. The classic statement, have sex with me or you're going to lose your job, that's pure speech. I realize my time is expiring and I do want my amici to have an opportunity to address.
Well, counsel, before you sit down.
Yes.
Is there a qualifier, number-wise, some measurement that has to be utilized here? For example, if he posted five times, okay, is that different than if he posts it 50 times?
Well,
which goes to the question of, you know, is the stalking enhanced because there's more of a forum or more of an audience online? Is it, you know, one posting and 5,000 people read it and embrace it, or is it 5,000 postings and only one person sees it? What are we talking about here?
We're talking about the stature acquiring pattern of conduct, which is two instances within a short
so
period
two,
of time.
So two would do it.
Yes, but you have to remember that you still have to petition the court. There has to be a hearing. There has to be evidence. There has to be proof of actual mental distress. And so the number of postings, the reach of the speech and the effects on the victim and the specific intent of the perpetrator to cause that harm are all factors, but those are left for the trial court to decide.
Okay, and then this process through the trial court using the stalking takes the place of having to have a civil proceeding to declare this libelous and the resulting damages as a result.
Yes, because you're looking at two absolutely distinct harms and two separate categories of categorically unprotected speech. Defamation claims seek to restore your reputation and provide you monetary damages. The menacing by stalking statute seeks to prevent further harm to the victims and provide an injunction against future conduct and harm.
But the first would also have that same, could have that same directive, that you can't post it and, you know, for future dissemination.
You can find overlap, but they're absolutely distinct remedies, and they do address different harms. And there's also the issue of speed and expeditious relief. As you're all aware, a defamation trial involves years of proceedings, tens if not hundreds of thousands of dollars, and the General Assembly wants to provide effective relief to our victims.
Can the General Assembly violate the Constitution?
No.
So even if that's the General Assembly's intent, we still have to look at whether it's constitutional or not, correct?
Well, the statute itself here is not at issue. We're looking at these protection orders, but I would say that, you know, it's, yeah, it certainly the General Assembly can't pass unconstitutional laws.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chief Justice, Justices of the Supreme Court, my name is Alexandria Rudin, and I'm a family law attorney at the Legal Aid Society of Cleveland since 1984. The relevant question should be whether this online posting ban is a legal safeguard against further stalking behavior, and I submit it is. Each of Ohio's protection orders are designed to bring about a cessation of violence and ensure the safety and protection of victims. Each protection order is designed to restrain future harm because of past conduct that a court has already found to be unlawful in the first instance. What Mr. Raceware is asking you to do is eliminate the valid constraints protecting Joni Bay and Becky Raceware from his harassing and threatening conduct. The consequences of not restricting this threatening conduct is to put Joni Bay and Becky Raceware in a no-win situation. They will either have to continue to find themselves harassed, or they will have to self-censor, silence themselves, and remove themselves.
What about filing a libel suit?
Well, under the civil stalking and all the protection order statutes, so in this case it would be 2903.214G, a civil stalking protection order is in addition to, but not in lieu of, any other civil or criminal remedies. To file a defamation suit addresses damage after it is done, but doesn't restrain future conduct.
But
and
it can.
That is what
wait a minute,
we're
wait a minute.
Doing.
It can be the order of the court if it's found this language and the subject matter is found to be defamation, restrain, or you're in contempt of court.
That may be, but really the goal of a defamation, it's only during the time the case is pending. The goal is monetary damages, and you have to prove every element of defamation. And under the stalking statute, there's a provision, and I will quote this, on what to post a message is. And to post a message, according to the statute, is to any transfer, send, publish, disseminate, or attempt to do so, any message or information, whether truthful or untruthful, about an individual, and whether done under one's name, under the name of another, or while impersonating another. So in this case, the court, who was empowered to create the remedy, targeted the remedy to only these two women.
Counsel, we've been talking about speech so far, but you used the word threaten. Was there a threat of violence in this case?
There were three things that Becky Rasawer and Joni Bay found very problematic. One, Mr. Rasawer posted, "Becky must die." Two, he said something about designed to exact revenge. And then he had a call to action, which can be interpreted to mean you would keep, I want everyone else in the community to begin to harass them. I think what started out as speech becomes conduct when it is persistent, unwanted, and unwarranted, like in this case. So we're not really, what started out looking at the message becomes, the message is irrelevant. What these women wanted was for the harassing behavior to stop, because we have to balance the free speech of Mr. Rasawer to post whatever he wants in whatever medium he wants to post against his victim's rights not to be intruded into, not to have his speech or his conduct intrude into their lives. And that is a balancing act.
Thank you, Counsel.
You're welcome.
You've used more than your time.
I know, thank you.
Counsel, you have a little over almost 2.5 minutes.
I will be as quick as I can, Your Honor.
Counsel, I wonder if you could start with that point. Was there evidence below that these were threats of violence?
I don't believe there were, Your Honor. The statement about revenge, much ado has been made about that. The exact quote was, "The best revenge is one that creates a better day." It didn't say anything about hurting somebody. And
Did it say that somebody should die?
It did say that she should die. It did not say that he was going to commit any specific threat to her, and it was not communicated directly to her. It was more of an opinion that that's what he thought should happen.
You can see how that would be distressful.
I can understand how somebody may take it that way, but
I'm sure I would take it that way.
But
I would be surprised if you didn't.
I understand, Your Honor.
Counsel, are you familiar with the case of Knox versus Pennsylvania?
I'm not, Your Honor.
Okay.
But I do have one point that I want to bring up as in what the amici for the appellee said. She said that you need to balance here. The Stevens case in particular, which was a case in which they were seeking a prohibition on animal cruelty depicting video, specifically informed us and this court that we should not engage in ad hoc balancing. That is an incredibly dangerous thing to do, to try to value speech in regards to what harm it may cause.
Counsel, also, was your client present at this hearing?
He was.
And was he represented?
He was.
And did he have the opportunity to testify?
He did.
And did he testify?
He did not. And he invoked his Fifth Amendment in part because the prosecution was there, and also there were pending criminal charges for speech-related crimes in which he was largely acquitted on later, and so he had to invoke his Fifth Amendment right. But one thing that's important is that he did seek to provide the court with evidence of the truthfulness of these statements, and the court declined to hear it.
Well, apparently it doesn't matter if the statements are true or not.
Well, and I think the argument is that that does not square with constitutional precedent.
What do you mean?
It needs to be determined to be libelous under the O'Brien case and United States Supreme Court precedent in order for it to be restrained.
Okay, well, I guess maybe under a civil libel, you know, suit, but under the stalking, it could be, and I, you know, any kind of speech. If, for example, he was posting his undying love repeatedly for one of these women, and you know, at every opportunity, he's saying flattering things about them excessively, and that was unwanted.
Mm-hmm. If I may, Your Honor, I recognize I'm out of time. This gets back to this distinction between one-to-one communication versus something
about
somebody.
Well, I'm posting it, saying, you know, I'm telling the world that I'm in love with so-and-so, and here's what our future is going to be like together, and, you know, just the fantasy stuff that...
Sure. I think that unless it falls under some sort of exception, existing.
But it causes the person mental distress. They're looking over their shoulder to see if this, suitor is going to show up at work, going to be at their doorstep, are there going to be flowers? I mean, let's talk about, you know, it's all positive, I guess, in some people's minds.
And
is that a problem?
I believe that the Illinois Supreme Court recently just determined that in the Relaford case, it was actually a very similar fact pattern, somebody who was giving unwanted advances to somebody. And in that case, they said that the Gaboni case, the speech integral to criminal conduct, has to be integral to another statute, not a statute that specifically deals with speech for the same reasons as seditious libel laws would be problematic. If you simply say that the speech itself is the crime and the speech is integral to the speech itself, you are opening the door for government censorship. So it needs to be integral to another statute.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision. Marshall, will you call a recess?